Welcome to Drunk Guys Book Club, where books aren't just for school, book clubs aren't just for women, and beer gives you plus one against book clubs.
I'm Mike.
I'm Nate.
And we're the Drunk Guys. And this week we are reading Ready Player One by Ernest Cline.
Before we talk about what happens in the book, I need a beer.
Yes.
So,
Nate, you brought this one over. I mean, it kind of makes sense for what the book's about.
Sure. All right. So this beer is called The Calling. Here's why. It's because the main character and all his friends are on a hunt for this Easter egg inside of a video game. And yes, we'll explain why that makes sense in a minute. But they've been hunting for this for years, and they feel that hunting for this Easter egg is their calling. That they do it for the purity of the game, well, and for the $100 billion they'll get if they win. But, you know, they're purists. They don't want to see the terrible corporation actually get all the money. So, you know, it's their calling.
This is The Calling by Boulevard Brewing Company from Kansas City, Missouri. And we actually had a different beer there a little while back. We did The Road. So I like their stuff. This is the first time I've had this one. It is a double IPA coming in at 8.5% alcohol, 75 IBUs. All right, right. Super tropical mango, pineapple kind of smell coming off of it.
Nice. Tastes like a strong IPA.
It's not overly bitter. It's really balanced out. You know, you get a sweetness to make it palatable. It's not a destroyer of palates. I read something recently. That is trending for beer nerds on Twitter. Most beers that claim to have 100 IBUs or more really don't. Based on science that I don't really understand at that point, unless you're using really concentrated hop oils, you're actually not going to get more than 100 IBUs. Though I think the human palate really can't distinguish anything more than like 130 IBUs anyway. If I ever see it, a beer I had it years ago called 1,000 IBU.
I've heard of that.
And tasted pretty fucking hoppy, but compared to a 100, like a beer like a Dogfish Head, 120 minute, I think that's like much hoppier than that. Didn't taste like it. Maybe I'm not a super taster. This is excellent. So in the book, they take place in the future. It's like 2044. The world has gone through this energy crisis.
Mm-hmm.
And our protagonist, Wade Watts, is a teenager, right?
Yeah.
He's poor. He lives in this poor district that is just trailer parks. Trailers. Stacked on top of like skyscrapers or trailers, which is a really interesting vision. And he spends the majority of his time plugged into this immersive video game that is like half Matrix, half World of Warcraft called Oasis. And he works as an egg hunter, which they call gunters.
He's also a high school student because he's doing this while he's in high school. Oh, and his high school is in the Oasis, is in this virtual reality, all-encompassing virtual reality game called the Oasis.
Which I think is the goal of the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, to have education be remote and computerized.
I'm not sure about them, but the new Facebook initiatives, that might be.
That might be what they're looking for. That might be wrong by Bill Gates. Whatever. He doesn't listen to this.
Hopefully not.
You know what? Hopefully yes.
Yeah, hopefully he does.
And then he'll be really upset that he knows it was recorded on a Mac. Steve Jobs is listening wherever he is. Or not.
Or not.
He's listening to his doctors. So,
wow, we're getting pretty off topic already. It's okay.
So they spend their time, the Gunters, looking for an Easter egg. So if you don't know what an Easter egg is, you're not quite nerdy enough for the rest of this episode, but bear with us. An Easter egg is a thing hidden particularly inside of video games, but also movies and TV shows, that is only for the super dedicated to find. It could be
an extra
joke.
Puzzle, an extra prize. It's supposed to be extra difficult and not part of the main whatever. It's sort of supposed to be an extra thing.
Yes, you don't need it to beat the game, but it's like seeing, I can't think of a good example. It's like, I guess like finding the minus one world in Super Mario. That's a bit of an Easter egg. Where there's the one in Zelda, Link to the Past. There's like the special room that you could get to only when the game glitched a certain way. I can't remember. There was a contest in Nintendo Power that if the winner would get their name in the Zelda game. And that's where they put it, in the glitch Easter egg room.
Huh.
The kid's name was there, the guy's name. Those sort of things. Or just to have, Metroid, that you get Samus to be in a bikini for the game instead of being in a room.
Yeah.
But it's like 8-bit bikini, so it's really not. You really have to work really hard to make that work. So,
well, 1987, that's all you had.
Yeah, so it was that or an old Hustler. So half those pages are stuck together, so you couldn't really use them. So Easter egg in the game is the clue, or there are three Easter eggs, right?
So, all right, we got to move back a little bit. So here's what happened. The creator of this all-encompassing game and his company, the creator who's worth billions and billions of dollars and has no children, when he dies, instead of leaving his vast fortune, probably the biggest in the world, to anybody, he says, whoever finds my Easter egg wins my entire inheritance. Not just all this money, which is literally $100 billion. Maybe it was 200. It was just a huge amount of money. And my controlling share in the company, the one that creates this game.
That is part of life in every form. This is a thing some people never... They rarely leave the world, the oasis.
And the main character basically doesn't, except when he absolutely has to for, well, we'll get into that later. So anyway, the sky dies. What was his name again?
Halliday,
who created this, who created all of these Easter eggs, or the Easter egg you have to find to win the game. He probably spent years and years putting all this together, all in secret, all on his own, because he's a master computer programmer, whatever. So that leads to... How in the world do you actually find these Easter eggs? And there are a couple of keys you have to find. Halliday was obsessed with the 1980s.
I think that's now when he's born?
So it was when he was a teenager. So yeah. What it says in the book is he always loved all the stuff from the 80s, the early video games, the movies, the music, the TV shows, everything related to the 80s. He loved and was obsessed with. And he always wanted everyone to be as obsessed with stuff like that, like he did. Suspend your disbelief right there, even though it's a little bit weird. But anyway, so the way to actually get anywhere on to find this Easter egg is you have to, all the egg hunters, also known as gunters in their calling, they have to obsessively learn about everything from the 80s, about all the pop culture from the 80s, I should say.
And there's a document that I think other gunters have put together, which they call Anorak's Almanac. Because Anorak is the nickname.
Actually, I think he put it together. It's his journal.
Oh, okay. Yes, that's right. You're right. It's a journal. He put it together.
Like 1,000 pages of random stuff about 80s pop culture.
And the gunters treat this like the Talmud, and they memorize it and can interpret and quote and interpolate all these ridiculous things from the 80s. That includes, you know, every shitty arcade game that came out. TV shows that are just god awful, movies that were like war games is a movie that will become important here in the book. Anorak is Halliday's name in the game, right? Because you're in the video game world, you have an avatar, and Anorak is his avatar.
So this guy was also obsessed with Dungeons and Dragons,
which is an 80s thing,
and role playing games in the computer role playing games that came afterward.
So the Gunters learn all this 80s shit, and they're convinced, correctly so, because Halliday tells them that the answers to the Easter egg are within there somehow. But it's not simple. It's not like they just need to know, you know, what happens in episode 93 of ALF or whatever the fuck it is. They have to put together these things in some weird clues. And for years, nobody makes any progress at all. There's a thing called the scoreboard that has all, you know, like picture in 1980s arcade game scoreboard. It's just numbers 1 to 10, player name, high score. It is blank. There are no scores. Well, our main character, Wade, he figures out the first thing.
The first clue. Literally, 5 years have gone by from when Halliday died, and it's our protagonist, the teenager, Wade, who finds the very first clue and becomes the very first person on the scoreboard.
And that is a worldwide important event, right? That's a phenomenon, because for many people kind of half thought there was no real Easter egg. It was all an elaborate put on. Now they see the name up there. There was already huge interest in this. Now it is even more so. And that's really where the book gets interesting. Because you meet lots of other Gunters who are looking. And some are good, some are bad, some are kind of indifferent. They're all interesting in their nerdiness. And eventually they will find this Sagless. He finds the first of three keys. Because it can't just be one Easter egg. It's a bunch of different things. So he finds the first. Then they move on to a second and third.
It would be a much shorter book. If there was only one.
Though even it was actually kind of long, right?
It was kind of like
400 or 500 page book, but it's a breezy read because it's half of it is just talking about like fucking Dukes of Hazzard reruns or something. Well, that's actually a 70s thing, but
it's a young adult book too, so it's not written with the highest reading level.
No, I don't think it's going to stump you on too many vocabulary words, which is fine. That's not to say it makes it bad. Because I actually really liked it. I enjoyed it.
I thought it was really clever and funny and really interesting.
So throughout the book, Wade meets other people, including Artemis, who, of course, because it's nerdy, she spells the E, and Artemis is a 3, and she's, you know, the cute other girl avatar.
Her avatar.
Yes.
It's incredibly good-looking, because everyone's avatar, you can make it whatever you want. In the game, you don't have to be yourself. You can be somebody entirely different. So, of course, everybody is the most idealized, that has the most idealized body, male or female, or probably, you know, all other variations on that.
It is
the internet.
Plus 3 to penis size.
Only plus 3?
But I was talking in feet. So they go, he meets the other gunters, they go around, they look for their shit, And of course, there's like an evil corporation, which I totally forget their name right now.
IOI.
Yes, IOI. What is that for? I have no idea what that stands for.
It stood for something, but.
Yeah. Internet of Idiots. IOI are the bad guys. And they, of course, approach Wade. His avatar, his name is Percival.
Percival, yeah.
With Z's, because he's badass. Percival.
Named after one of the Knights of the Round Table.
Yes.
Showing how nerdy he was.
That's a deep cut, for because that's not a particularly 80s thing.
That's an Easter egg on Drunk Guys Book Club podcast.
Yeah. So they, of course, are like, oh, why don't you work for us? Because Wade is poor. He's using a shitty setup to do his Gunthering. Right? There's better equipment in the world. You don't have to just use, it's not just a laptop, right? You have like a virtual reality headset. And then he, throughout the book, as he becomes more successful at Gunthering, he gets really cool upgraded gear.
He gets sponsored.
That's what it is.
He gets commercially sponsored because he's now world famous for being the first person, first Gunter to ever actually find even the first part of the game. So he's world famous. He quickly signs these endorsement deals. And that's how we finally get some money.
Right. That's a good point. I forgot.
He finally gets some money so he can buy his upgraded equipment instead of his shitty school-issued VR headset.
That helps him change because he's kind of like a fat, out of shape, uncool kid. When he gets the better equipment, he gets the machine where it's like a chair that is so immersive that whatever your avatar is experiencing, your body does. So he plays the video game and gets in shape, which is absurd. And that is something only a video game nerd could wish for. That's like, that'd be wish maybe number two for a video game nerd. Right after
plus three.
Yes. Right after the plus three, or just finding out the ultimate nerd Easter egg, what and where is a clitoris? How do I get to one? So he gets all cool. He's now celebrity, and Artemis and him had this sort of like, will they, won't they get together thing, because it's a YA novel. There's a little romance thing there.
But totally on the internet. They don't meet each other in real life until the very end, but you know,
yes. That's
just the way it works. So this is still an online relationship, and they've never met each other in real life.
And IOI, the shitty company, they are so invested in getting this because if they win, if one of their agents wins the whole thing, they become extremely wealthy and they have sort of contracts with other Gunters to do this work for them. And they will, you know, I guess the Gunter gets something, but the company really keeps all the money and then it'll be the most powerful wealthy company in the world. And they'll control this thing, which the Oasis is free.
Yep.
So I think that's kind of like in there, right? Like, aren't they they're going to make a lot of money. They'll control. They can charge people for it. They can do all these things that shitty corporations do in simplistic novels terms. they're just cartoonishly evil. There's nothing. It's not like they want to win so they could do anything with the money except for just to be wealthy and powerful. Fast forward throughout the book, they find the rest of the shit, of course, because that you know is going to happen from the beginning. Of course, Wade is the one that finds. He doesn't find every. He's not always the exact first person to do it, but he finds almost everything. And the important thing he gets is he gets an extra life. He gets a quarter.
Ha.
Right? He has to play through Pac-Man. That was like the second quest, the second Easter egg step. Play through Pac-Man. Now, Pac-Man, the original arcade game, had 256 levels. And at the, I guess for whatever coding reason, like that number of letters.
It's 2 to the 8th.
Well, that, sure, why not?
So, because the original processors, like Nintendo, or if you really want to go into this, were 8-bit processors, which means they could only hold 8 digits in binary. And so, which means on or off, 1 and 0, that's two digits. So, 2 to the 8th, that's how many possible combinations there are. Like, literally, the computer, this is a very simple computer, could not handle numbers bigger than 256. Technically, 255, because 0 was a number. They could not handle a number bigger than 255. So they couldn't make a level 256 or 257 because the computer cannot count that high.
Well, so what happens in the original Pac-Man game is at level 256, the game becomes unplayable. Half of the screen, like, so you know, Pac-Man works, you've got to go around. It glitches, half the screen doesn't work anymore. So there are people, not just a person, but people who do this, and now the world records to do it faster, play through the entire game of Pac-Man to level 256 when the game technically ends without missing a point, without losing a life. You have to get a perfect score. And that's one of the things Wade has to do. He gets the perfect score. In Pac-Man, the prize is a quarter, which is kind of funny because that's what you use to play the games. It's kind of a little joke. But he saves that. He knows it's valuable somehow. And that's what's going to help him at the very end to defeat all the bad dudes. When they find the site of the last place, and IOI has all their goons trying to figure out how to get into the last place, get the last key, get the money. And they erected a force field around it that doesn't let anybody in, which is totally not in the spirit of the hunt. Or the Easter egg hunt was supposed to be this camaraderie thing, or just like may the best man win sort of thing. And of course, the corporation goes and ruins it by being dickbags. There's like a he bombs it, and he like detonates some sort of bomb to kill them all, and it kills him too. But because he has the quarter, the extra life, he can go back and then go in. And then there's something else where like they have a fight, and he's like, someone's a Godzilla villain.
So there's an epic fight at the end, and this is all inside the video game. And everybody. So the other thing about the Oasis, the video game, is every other video game you've ever heard of, or every science fiction or fantasy, whatever, has been recreated inside the video game. And the whole video game is a role-playing game. Like, your avatar starts at level 1, and then you have to go kill kobolds to get to level 2, and then level 3, and you have to level up, and you can collect all these magical items and super sci-fi technology, and you put them in your inventory, just like it's a game.
But you don't have to spend time in the forest killing boars.
Right. No, you do. That's what you do at level 1. But anyway, so the very end is, like, the highest level, like, the corporate guys, the IOI guys, and they're all their magical sci-fi and sci-fi equipment versus the Gunters. And so one of the head of the corporation has Mecha Godzilla, and it's versus all the Gunters, and they're like almost as cool shit. I have to admit, that was a really cool part. Like, it's Mecha Godzilla.
it's a little
you know, because they've gone and found all the coolest items in the game, and so it's really like all the coolest items versus all the coolest items.
He's Ultraman. That's who he is.
Ultraman.
He's Ultraman. I mean, you knew from the beginning that Wade was going to solve this and going to win, because why are we focusing in this worldwide quest on the pimply, overweight teenager? Oh, because he's going to win it.
Yeah.
That was a lot of fun.
It was a very fun book.
It was fun. And as someone who fancies himself a little nerdy, I was overwhelmed by my lack of nerdiness reading this book, which is kind of refreshing.
There were some things I didn't know.
There was a lot I didn't know, especially about the arcade game stuff, because this is before my time, I must admit. Now, the 80s has always been an interesting... I was born in the 80s. I was born at the end of the 80s. Nate was born a little earlier in the 80s.
Right.
So my memory of the 80s is all under the lens of nostalgia. I was either a toddler, you know, I was born in 87, so it's not... I really didn't experience the 80s. You know, I was born under Reagan, but it's not like I know any fucking shit about him firsthand. I know it as a from history. I know I've watched 80s TV, but always on rerun. Unless it was Sesame Street, I guess I watched that live or new or whatever, Mr. Rogers or something.
Well, they're still making new episodes of Sesame Street, so that never went away. But
right, how
long ago did Mr. Rogers die?
It's kind of a long time. You know what? I'm going to bring it together. I think he died when I was in high school. Which when I was in high school, actually, the 80s was like the cool decade. Everyone kind of went to high school. So you can do the math. It's high school, the early 2000s. A lot of people thought the 80s was really cool. There was on VH1. There was I Love the 80s. Was a popular show, and then they made I Love the 80s 2, or I Love the 80s Strikes Back, or whatever it was. And they I Love the 80s yet again, or I Love the 80s. Oh no, please not anymore. And like there's a whole bunch of these I Love the 80s programs, but they just had comedians talk about 80s pop culture shit, and I loved it because it was stuff that I kind of knew a little bit about. So I'm like, oh yeah, I had an older cousin who had that toy. Or we had one of those when I was really little, and now I know what the fuck that was. Like, I really didn't play with that because I didn't know what Voltron was or whatever. Not only that, but 80s music was always revered and seen as this, like, oh, we missed out on that. I think this is typical teenage behavior to think that whatever's around when you missed something. Or at least maybe that's a fairly recent, maybe the past few decades, teenage phenomenon. Like, oh, we're in the shitty times. We missed the really good stuff. Which is so ridiculous now that I look back on it that by missing new wave music like the Go-Go's and, I don't know, the Bengals.
Duran Duran.
And hair metal. I guess actually I kind of like hair metal stuff. That I missed out something important. Like, there was awesome shit in the 90s. I just didn't know about it yet because I was a stupid kid. So everybody really liked 80s shit when I was in high school. All the people I knew. I don't know if that was the same for you.
I mean, I think I was weird, but I did not like... I've never liked 80s pop culture. I've never found it interesting. I didn't like the music. I didn't watch the TV shows, so I kind of didn't know a lot of this stuff. Though I'd heard of the movies like War Games, and I've seen all those fucking Breakfast Club movies. I've seen them, you know, whatever. But I've never really been into the 80s. Now, 60s and 70s, I was totally into that, but maybe it's just because I'm a little bit older.
You also have your parents were into that.
Like, yeah.
And that's a big part, too, like what your relationship is like with if you have older siblings or older cousins or your parents, what they're into and how receptive you are to that.
It's almost like your parents are into the things from when they were teenagers. So when your parents were teenagers, it's important. You are probably going to have familiarity with the music, movies, whatever, pop culture from when your parents are teenagers. So that's where the nostalgia comes from. You know, that's where it becomes kind of popular. You're going to be familiar with that, but you're not going to be as familiar with stuff after that. There's like this gap. And then your parents have kids, and then you're a little kid, and you're not able to pay attention to pop culture because you just, you know,
nor are your parents because of changing diapers.
Yeah, they're not into it either. And then suddenly you're a teenager, and everybody's really into NSYNC. It's like, oh my god, this is disgusting.
That's true. Yeah, I know.
And then the pop culture of your own time, which is just horrible.
Though you will, as now I'm experienced as a 30-year-old, kind of like some of that garbage, including the band garbage. I like stuff from when I was it sort of filtered out from like the sifted and like a minor. Yeah, just the nuggets.
Just the gold nuggets of 90s pop culture and early 2000s.
Though there's stuff that I you know, thanks to like, I think really in terms of music, when I think of pop culture for this thing at least, thanks to shit like Spotify and Pandora,
yeah,
where I can say, I really like this band from the 90s, I have found a lot of other things that I like. It's like, oh, people who like this also like this, and I'm always, more times than not, oh, I also like that fucking weird alternative music from the 90s, which was the decade that when I was in high school it was hip to not like. And I like the 80s stuff too, which I like the 80s as an interesting compliment to this book, because the 80s was, everything seemed like the future, right?
Right.
Like, everything was electronic, like the music, it sounds, now it doesn't really sound like the future as it turned out, but
anymore.
It sounded futuristic when it was just choo-choo and just fucking stupid.
All the music was synthesizers.
Yeah, and synthesizer was cool. Like, we're just creating this with the power of the atom. Which, that's actually a 1950s kind of thing, but it seemed really cool. Speaking of 1980 shit, now this one is a bit of a stretch, I must admit, to connect to the book. But fuck it. I was drunk. One of the big arcade games of the 80s was Space Invaders. And I found this beer called Close Encounters Black IPA by Pipeworks Brewing Company, which I love their artwork as well. It really looks like the sort of thing you'd see on an arcade machine, like on the body of it, on the what do you call it, the case?
Cabinet.
Cabinet, there you go. It's a black IPA, which we talked about black IPA and my theories on that. And no one has told me they're wrong, but feel free to tweet us at drunkguysbc or send us an email at drunkguysbookclub@gmail.com. That is definitely black colored, and I poured it a little vigorously, so it's like 90% foam.
The foam tastes good.
The beer is the Easter egg. You have to work really hard to get to it.
The beer gives you -2 for speaking coherently.
It gives you +4 for thinking you're talking to girls coherently, but -6 for actually talking to girls coherently.
Yeah.
Which is true. But actually, this is really nice. You know, again, I don't know what black IPA means. I know what IPA is. I know what like a black lager is. This has a roasted taste to it. Sort of almost coffee notes.
It tastes like a dark beer.
Which I get where the black comes from in the title. I get where the color, under some of the colors. The head even has a nice base. Like if you just saw this in a glass, you would think this was a stout or a porter. But it is very bitter, very hoppy. It's not. And the bitterness is interesting because you get a different bitterness from the roast of the malt than you get from just the hops. So there's two, you know, there's like an astringent bitterness that you get from the hop, from the malted barley. The roast of the malted barley, and then there's that fruity, sometimes more, in this case, more earthy, the right word, bitterness that you get from the hops.
It's funny, comparing it with our double IPA, which is a real regular IPA, but a double IPA, so extra strong. It is not as bitter as the other IPA, for sure.
It's
definitely different. It definitely tastes like a stout.
It is different. It is only 6% alcohol, so I'm sure the hop character is dialed down as well. It's not as hoppy, whatever. So, we were going on about culture, the book. Why the 80s, though? And why... This book was a bestseller. Like, the 80s is, like, fetishized.
Not only a bestseller, but a bestseller young adult book for kids probably who, you know... I mean, it came out a couple years ago now.
They were born maybe in 1999.
Yeah, for kids who definitely never experienced the 80s, whose parents were in high school in the 80s. You know what? That's probably
that's
it,
might
right
be
there.
It. But you know what, though? Not everyone's... The thing is, like, this isn't representative of all 1980s pop culture. Like, there's no hip-hop in the book.
It's true.
There's no... I mean, that's a big part of it. That was a huge part of 80s pop culture. There's nothing about crack. That was another big part of 80s just awareness. It really was. It was a big deal. You had fucking Pee Wee Herman making commercials. PSAs to not smoke crack. Have you ever seen it? It's hysterical.
I have not seen that.
There's this, they'd have these ones where it's like a person sitting on a stool in a darkened room, but you just kind of see the outline of them, and then the light would dramatically turn on, like, and the light turns on.
And it's
and they'd have them with, like, different people. Like, they have, like, Nancy Reagan, and it's like the Just Say No thing. So it's like Nancy Reagan, like, I don't know, Clint Eastwood, like old respectable people who are like, just say no, it's bad for you, kid. And then Pee-wee Herman, like not Paul Rubens, I'm sure they're like, that's a character, Pee-wee Herman. But no, he's in the gray suit with the red bow ties, just say no, kids. He's just, don't do it. Jumbie hates you smoke crack. Mecca Lecca High, Mecca just say no. but it's not funny. It's just, it's really bad, kids. Don't do crack. Oh, okay. Thanks, Pee-wee.
Don't do crack.
Tip for you, Pee-wee Herman. Don't jerk off in a porno theater like you will in the 1990s.
Yeah.
Which was a real thing.
Mm-hmm.
I remember that was front page news.
It was.
Sorry, Paul Rubens. I can't imagine you're listening to this, because you also didn't listen to the warning to not jerk off in the theater. So.
Quick, get in your DeLorean and go back to 1985 and tell him that.
Yeah, that's right. And I'll also tell Lawrence Fishburne, who was on the Pee-wee Herman show.
Right, yeah.
Don't worry. You're going to be really respected as an actor, but, like, not right now. You're going to be
a
fucking cowboy character for a few more years. But there's this thing called The Matrix that's going to happen, and you're going to be really cool all of a sudden. Definitely take the red pill.
What if I told you, Lawrence Fishburne, you would be really popular later?
So, I mean, why do you get, you're right, maybe because they're parents, but I've, and we like it, maybe there's, like, so is there, like, we're a generation, I guess a generation and change, what's a generation, is that 10 years, is it 20 years? It seems smaller and smaller as time goes on.
I mean, really, pop culture generations are more like 10 years.
So there's a generation between us and the kids who really liked this book when it came out.
Mm-hmm.
So how does that
overlap?
But
was it really the kids who made this popular, or was it the young adults or adults who were like, oh, the 80s, sweet.
That's true, there's no way to know. You know what I think?
Well, I'm sure somebody has data on that.
You know what helped? Young kids were like, oh, a book in video, with video games is the big part of it.
Sweet.
Yeah. Mom, leave me alone. I'm not touching it, Mom. You have to knock. Cast a spell of engorgement on my loins.
I found this +3 codpiece.
Oh, a fair maiden wench approaches you. Roll 10 or above to hit that.
Oh, miss.
Oh, better luck next time. you cast Wrist of Elasticity and retreat to your room. So, in the 80s, I guess, is just cool just because any other... I mean, you know what strikes me is not cool? The 70s. I would say, like, the 70s has... like, awesome. Like, I love Led Zeppelin. I like some of the Who stuff. And, like, I like the hard rock classic. But that, like, kind of stops for, like, 1974, 1975.
Mm-hmm.
Then the later part of the 70s, you got, like, disco. No,
well, later Zeppelin, which is also not so great.
Which is,
and
really,
you get all this disco.
No, I want to, like, pretend Zeppelin broke up after, like...
Physical Graffiti?
Really, yeah. Maybe if they just squeezed, like, two of the good songs up in through the outdoor onto Physical Graffiti. Like, I can live without Achilles' Last Stand or whatever. Like, I don't need that.
Fool in the Rain?
I kind of like Fool in the Rain.
That's the one you would pick?
Off of In Through the Outdoor? Well, the other good song on that is All My Love, which is also another fucking lame song.
So I've heard that on classic rock radio so many times.
Oh, yeah. When you get the let out. That's,
yeah, exactly.
That's the show. Yeah. Or are you going to prefer Carousel Lambra or whatever that fucking lame song? No. Or Hot Dog, whatever that song about Coda was.
You know, I haven't even heard a bunch of those later songs. I couldn't even tell you.
So, but they don't epitomize their time the way the Beatles epitomized the 60s. Or
right.
The way just... the fashion of the 80s seems, which it probably wasn't, right? It probably really wasn't from January 1st, 1980 to, you know, December 31st, 89, representative of it. It's huge changes. But we've kind of summarized it or compressed it down to just leg warmers, spandex, neon colors, big hair, guys wearing makeup and being in metal bands singing ballads, fucking chicks grinding on top of a car. Like, that's what I think of for the 80s, and I'm cool with all those things. 70s, I think, I'm like, well, there's, like, dirty rock bands who made really good music, but they look kind of vaguely homeless at times. Like, they look really high or, like, strung out because they're on really hard drugs. And then disco music, which is just atrocious. Though, there's a few disco songs I like because my mom listened to disco, so it's like, I've been inculcated with disco.
Mm-hmm.
And then like, punk rock, which actually, most of that music is horrible.
It's not my thing.
I like some. Like, I like this. I like one or two songs by the Sex Pistols and the Dead Kennedys and the Ramones and the Clash. But so much. I mean, like, that's, you can make, like, a double album of, like, the really good punk songs from the late 70s. There's a lot of just awful, incompetent musicians. So we're, like, way off pace.
Yeah.
Let's get to the book. I mean, there's an interesting thing about, like, escapism in this world, because the world sucks.
Mm-hmm.
It's the energy crisis. There's no. You got piss?
I was about to make a point.
Okay, the world sucks.
And then I'll piss. All right. So first, it struck me when I was rereading this that it's a utopia inside a dystopia. The Oasis. It gets better than that. Wait, I have a further point. But anyway, so it's a utopia inside a dystopia. Whereas inside the Oasis, you can be anything you want. Anything you want. You can be into anything you want. Whatever fantasy, sci-fi, music, movie, video game, whatever you were into, you could do that too. And you could create your own personality and create your own whatever. And lots of people prefer that to real life. And so the Oasis is almost like a utopia of freedom because it's all just digital everything. And the laws of physics don't apply anymore. So you can do whatever you want.
You can create your own planet.
You create your own planet. And in fact, all the planets you've ever heard of, even in, you know, the Star Trek universe, are already there. You know, somebody has already gone and created the Star Trek quadrant.
Do you think anybody created Alderaan? And then blew it up. Like, is there both an Alderaan?
Probably multiple times.
Not blown up and a real...
They probably have an Alderaan that gets blown up on a timer every 45 minutes.
That sounds like the restaurant at the end of the universe.
Mm-hmm. Another book we should do.
Another nerdy Easter egg for you. Don't tell them the author. Let them earn it.
They'll find it. They'll find it.
So, all right. So, what's your...
So, anyway, that's the utopia, but it's inside the dystopia of the actual real world is completely shitty because of the energy crisis, because the world has used up all of their oil and just they pumped out all the oil and used it. So, it's created this terrible global warming, but because there's no energy anymore, nobody can do anything. Nobody can even travel to the next town over. There's nothing to do. There are no jobs. There's no work. Everybody, you know, the main character just lives in this massive trailer park of skyscraper trailer park complex.
Trailer hive.
And that's the way I'm sure a lot of people live in the world. So it's a utopia inside a dystopia.
That is interesting. So this was written in 2011. I remember reading a lot about... So this means... Well, it was published 2011. It means it was written probably 2010, 2009. This is a guy's first book he might have been working on for years. Clearly the global warming, peak oil stuff. We used to hear about peak oil all the time. That kind of drizzled away. Just like the oil allegedly will. We don't really hear about that anymore. That influenced him. So whether I'm not going to... We're not going to debate...
Whether that's real or not.
Whether that's real or global warming, whatever, like whatever. But
it's a different podcast.
That's yes. His name is Al Gore, and he goes around and makes a movie about it every 15 years, and he gets an Academy Award. So just look out. It's actually in Inconvenient Truth 2 out now. Inconvenient Truth 2, this time it's personal.
Electric Boogaloo.
Electric car boogaloo. Yeah. So are we heading there?
Well, okay. Whether we're really on the track of this sort of like... dystopia of the real world where we have no energy, we have no anything. I would say hopefully not. You know, now that solar power and renewable energy has become so much cheaper, I think we're probably going to avoid that problem. Probably. However,
at least mitigate it.
The other question is, are we headed toward a universe, a real world where the internet takes up not just the amount of time it takes up now, it takes up everybody's existence all the time? Are we really headed to an internet that's just all encompassing of every social interaction you ever have? That's, I think, actually kind of probable.
That's fair. I'm just going to open another call.
Just a beer.
Really good. Pessimistically, I bet there are some people right now who live a lot of their life on the internet. Like 60-70% of their time is internet interactions.
Or 80-90% of their human-to-human interactions are actually on the internet.
Yeah.
They rarely leave their house. Well, okay, you can talk about their internet addiction is a real thing. Not only that is internet addiction a real thing, but people who got way too into World of Warcraft would literally not leave their house for days, months, years on end, and have like terrible agoraphobia. But really, all they do is play World of Warcraft, and so that is a real thing. Being completely obsessed with this online world—that's real.
That's
However, it's not everybody in the world. It's just a small percentage of Uber nerds in the real life. But however, are we headed to that direction? Maybe.
Is the internet becoming more and more part of our lives? Absolutely. Will it become a thing where we leave our lives and spend it in the internet? Or will we live our lives with just the internet as this, like, assistant? That I don't know. Or will something happen along the way? Like, I mean, people have tried to do other things, right? Like the fucking Google Glasses.
Right.
That didn't work.
Hasn't worked yet. I would argue it's inevitable that something similar to what Google Glass was trying to do will probably happen, where technology gets sophisticated enough where... You will, on the inside of your own glasses or your contact lenses, because that could also be a thing,
sure,
will tell you, you look at somebody, it will recognize the person and will bring up their social media profile. It will tell you their name, birth date, you know,
fuckability
rating.
They put on their penis.
Yeah, exactly. like that, unfortunately, that is probably reality.
I don't know if
and that's in the real world, which is not what Ready Player One says is going to happen.
I don't know if that's unfortunate, though. Like, technology, I don't think we should necessarily be afraid of technology. Technology is cool. Technology has made us not die of cholera. Technology is a pretty good thing.
Definitely.
Right? Like,
listen, I'm a nerd. I'm totally into technology.
I think the book has it both ways, right? The book makes the world is shitty because of what we've done in industrialization. But the nerds shall conquer the earth, and they have created the saving place.
No, the geek shall inherit the earth.
There you go.
That's what happened. So, here's the thing. I've already made the suggestion that the Oasis is a utopia. But is it really? Or is it really a dystopia?
Well, it's escapism. That's what it really is. I think it's not real. Like, no matter how much those people convince themselves that that's where their real life takes place, it's not real. And that's what utopia really means. Like, utopos, no place.
Mm.
So, it's not a real place. It's a place they go to escape. And I think the best example of that is the physical qualities of the characters are different in the other world. So Artemis, it turns out, is actually really cute at the end of the book. However, she is embarrassed or whatever. She has a birthmark on her face. So her avatar doesn't have the birthmark. Right? She corrects it in the fake world, which she thinks is incorrecting it. And Wade is fucking fat and nerdy and gets buff from playing the video game in the real world. Like and his avatar is all, you know, it's a 6'4" knight in armor, I forget what it was. But that's what they all, that's what every mm-hmm. fucking nerdy guy's avatar looks like. Yeah. It's a big, strong, barbarian-looking guy. And the female characters are all anatomically impossible porn stars. It's pretty sweet. add +2 to my thinking about baseball while I... So I think it's about escape for the characters in the book. It's not a real place. I think they know it's like any other entertainment, like watching TV or what the internet is for us now today. It's a thing to go to get away from these shitty real things, if only for a little while.
In the book, one character says that the Oasis has become a prison. So here's why it might be a dystopia. Because in reality, it's so amazing. It's so wonderful. It sucks everybody in so much. That's actually a prison. That no one likes who they are in real life. No one has any interaction with real people in real life. Only in the Oasis. Only on the internet. So it's actually imprisoned them into this world. Like, they would be dissatisfied with their actual self.
I think that's entirely fair and makes sense. Because who would want to live in the real boring world when you got four-star elf bitches and you could just increase the size of your member, the keystroke. Different kind of stroke than you usually use on your member. And who wouldn't want to live in that world? It must be disappointing. Like, how could the real world then not be dissatisfying?
Right? And that's what makes the Oasis a prison.
Burn. Dark.
Yeah.
Dark, because the book ends so optimistically.
It does. So, but here's my ultimate point. Isn't the book really a dystopia inside a utopia inside a dystopia?
That book is a Russian Matryoshka doll of Topias.
Topias.
Despite that, I guess, bummerish element of the book that I hadn't really thought about, it's still a lot of fun.
It is a very fun book.
And one worth reading. Alright guys, so join us next week when we go a totally different direction and read The Underground Railroad by Colson Whitehead. The Pulitzer Prize winning, and as of the recording date, Booker Prize nominated novel.
Let us know what you thought. Send us an email, drunkguysbookclub@gmail.com, or
follow us on Twitter @drunkguysbc as a book club. And give us a rating. If you're on iTunes, whatever you're going to do, just add 5 to it.
Just add 5 stars.
It'd be really helpful.
If you rate us less than 5 stars, we will find you.
Yes, just add +5 to podcast rating. And we'll see you next week.
See you next week.
Bye-bye.